I am John Cryer, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. A new series of Undisclosed started this week with an open and shut case, and we got all the information the police got on the night of the tragic murder of Tae Jung Ho, as well as getting some insight in how they arrived at the arrest of Chester Holman III within 10 minutes of the crime. With us this week is Rabia Chaudhry. She's a host of Undisclosed and the 45th podcast, as well as the author of Adnan's Story. Hey there, Rabia.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. Also with us is Colin Miller. He's one of the hosts of Undisclosed. He's also an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. How you doing, Colin?
Hey, John. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good. Also with us this week is Celeste Trusty. She's an advocate for the wrongfully convicted and criminal justice reform in Philadelphia. She's a blogger at thejuryroom.org, a mom, a volunteer with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and an extremely amateur weightlifter. Thank you for being here, Celeste. My first question has got to be, what do you bench?
Benching isn't really my thing. I'm more of a deadlifter.
Oh, okay. Got it. Yeah, because I've been benching, you know, because I'm like one of those Hollywood types with a personal trainer. So I've been benching easily 56, 57 pounds lately.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're doing that kind of level, I try to keep my reps low.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sorry, I don't want to talk shop with you. at any rate, thank you for being on the show. So you mentioned on the show, Celeste, that you had gotten into criminal justice while you were still studying. Is that correct?
Yeah, I actually went to undergrad for criminal justice and criminology. And I didn't want to work for law enforcement. I really wanted to look at wrongful convictions and how I could utilize my background in criminology to help wrongfully convicted. So being from Philly and knowing how Philadelphia justice was, I thought that Philadelphia would be a great place for me to kind of apply my skills. And then I went ahead to grad school and I was able to look at a couple different things around criminology and criminal behavior within grad school and kind of just went on from there. And I noticed a huge void for kind of advocacy in the area of wrongful convictions in Philadelphia. We definitely have the Innocence Project working on all the cases, but I felt like a lot of the families kind of needed a little more attention, a little more help, and a little more support. And so that's kind of where I went with my advocacy work.
So you're looking at it in a more holistic way, you know, at the people impacted by that.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned you were already studying criminology, so you already had an interest in it from when you were young?
Exactly. Yeah. Whenever I was little, I was always into mysteries and reading kind of, you know, mystery books and the Hardy Boys and, you know, kind of understanding cryptograms and all kinds of things like that whenever I was younger. And my first couple classes that I took in college were psychology and criminal justice. And I've always been interested in just the psychology behind criminal behavior and why people do the things they do. But again, I didn't really want to look at becoming a law enforcement agent. I wanted to look at criminal behavior and look at patterns within wrongful convictions and try to see if there was any way that I could look at different cases and see if there was anything that had been missed or overlooked or find different ways that I could advocate for the people themselves.
You mentioned in the episode that you emailed several prisoners. First of all, I wasn't aware that prisoners sentenced for violent crimes had access to email at all. How does that even work in a prison
setting? Yeah, actually, in certain states, they do actually have access to email. Pennsylvania is one of those. I know Virginia. I also have an inmate that I contact in Virginia that has access to email. But Pennsylvania does allow their inmates to access email, which is great. I still do like to write regular letters through the mail, and I like to receive regular letters through the mail. I feel like it's nice. It's kind of a lost art getting regular letters, but it's easy being able to email them back and forth. You can contact them pretty much whenever you want. And it's nice. You can just look them up by their inmate number and you can contact them. And a lot of them are very happy to have people reach out to them and become their friends.
I would imagine. So where would one look up inmate numbers like that? Is there just a website in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, it's easy. You can just look up on the DOC. There's an inmate locator and you can just look up on it's called Connect Network. And they're the email provider for Pennsylvania. You can just search the inmates by their inmate number and feel free to reach out. just a word of advice, I would definitely just do a little bit of research about the person before you, you know, and know their case a little bit before you reach out, because you do have to put some, you know, personal information in there whenever you sign up for an account. But, you know, I've made some of the most amazing friendships and relationships through my advocacy work with the incarcerated, with them and their families. And so it's definitely something that if you're interested in, I would go ahead and reach out to somebody.
Now, how did you become so involved with the Chester's case specifically?
So Chester's case specifically, last April, there was an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer about Chester's case. And I'd already really been involved in the wrongful conviction circuit in Philadelphia. But Chester's case had never really come across my my computer until that article. So back in April of 2017, there was actually an article in the newspaper, in the local newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, that brought up Chester's case. And the first thing I noticed that kind of was a red flag to me was that he was prosecuted by Roger King. And Roger King actually prosecuted a lot of the other cases that I had been interested in. And so right away, any case that was prosecuted by Roger King, when there's an innocence claim, I automatically want to look into that case and see if there's anything that I can find that might establish a pattern with the wrongful convictions. And once I looked into Chester's case and saw the things that that Roger King did, I definitely thought that it was time to reach out to him and kind of hear his story and let him know what I was doing. And Chester, he responded right away. Of course, he was a little apprehensive at first because he's been through quite a bit in his life and has a little bit of, understandably so, and, you know, issues trusting certain people. But once he opened up, it really has been an awesome, awesome experience getting to know Chester and his family. And I'm really, really glad that I decided to reach out to him.
Well, I have to say, it must be fraught communicating with people in this kind of situation, because you're entering the relationship not trusting, you know, understandably, because somebody's, you know, been accused and convicted of murder often in these cases, and they're not trusting you. I mean, that must be a very delicate dance at the beginning.
Yeah, you know, it really is. I kind of start out with a little bit about my background when I contact them to let them know that I actually do have an educational background in this. I'm not just some, you know, somebody looking out to, you know, befriend inmates, which is a fantastic, fantastic cause, but I actually do want to make a difference in their lives and in their cases. And so, before I reach out to anybody, I do do some research. I do look at whatever case files are available, and just kind of form my own opinion on their innocence claim. And once I determine that I believe in their innocence, I go ahead and reach out. And if they're willing to speak to me and, you know, become my friend, then I do whatever I can for them.
Also, I'll bet a few of them are into weightlifting.
They are.
So you have that in common.
Exactly, including Chester. He is very, very big into weightlifting. And so he's one of the guys who do one of the monthly workouts that I write for a bunch of my wrongfully convicted and wrongfully incarcerated people across the state. And this month actually is February for Freedom, and in honor of Chester. And he's huge into weightlifting. He actually, he does a lot of weightlifting competitions in jail, which is great. And I'm kind of proud of him for it.
How is he emotionally in prison right now?
Right now, it's kind of interesting. So I was able to share a little bit of the first episode with him. And it was tough for him because, you know, emotionally, he's been through this emotional roller coaster for almost 27 years of his life now. And hearing the outline of his story was definitely difficult for him, but he was so encouraged knowing that people are listening to him and that his story is being told through this media outlet. And he was so happy that his family was able to be there with me to listen to the first episode. So right now he really is very, very hopeful. He's excited with the new DA leadership in Philadelphia right now. He's very hopeful because of the article that recently came out and now the podcast. And so he really feels good right now, which is, it makes me feel good also.
Well, it also must have been really interesting to hear the case represented with all those first accounts that you heard, which, you know, admittedly paint a picture that, you know, it could well, you can certainly understand why law enforcement would focus on him at first.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we saw, well, you know, as we saw in the Willie Vesey case, it's impossible not to notice that the disparity between the many witness statements of the crime as to the number of people involved in the crime and other issues. Does this explain why cops and prosecutors frequently grab onto the wrong narrative because, you know, they have different accounts and it gives them room for confirmation bias to creep in. Do you believe that's what happened in this case?
I'm not sure if that's necessarily what happened in this case. It definitely happens. You know, in this case, I'm not sure whether it was confirmation bias or just a rush to try to get a conviction in this case because of the other types of crimes that were happening in Philadelphia at the time. They rushed to judgment in a lot of different murder cases back in the 80s and 90s. It was a very, very violent, violent time. You know, I understand, hey, it was easy, but it was easy to arrest Chester. He was close to the crime. He was in a very, very similar car. But I'm not sure if it was necessarily tunnel vision or whether it was just a lazy way to get a conviction in this case. As you'll see in future episodes, you know, from the facts stated in the first episode, it makes sense. It kind of is easy to understand why Chester would be arrested. But as is going to be revealed in the future episodes, it really does become very, very tricky. And it kind of makes you question really the motives behind this conviction.
Hims is a new wellness brand for men, and it's based on a simple premise that I'm sure most of you will recognize to be true. Far too many men don't take care of themselves. We're not proactive about our health, and when we start feeling aches and pains, and even worse, far too often we don't know to admit to ourselves that we need to see a doctor or don't want the inconvenience or sometimes embarrassment of getting the medical care we need. Hims is filling that need with a user-friendly website that lets you connect with doctors and get the prescriptions you need, all from the convenience of your computer or tablet. Hims is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and sexual wellness for men. They have medical-grade solutions and real doctors, offering well-known generic equivalents to name-brand prescriptions. These aren't herbal supplements, they're prescription solutions backed by science. And there's no waiting room, no awkward doctor's visits. You can save hours by going to forhims.com. Just answer a few quick questions, a doctor will view your file, talk with you, and prescribe you the medication you need, which will come directly to your front door. And you can follow up with that same doctor once you've started your treatment regime. The first thing that Hims is tackling is hair loss. 66% of men lose their hair by age 35. And when you start to notice this hair loss, it's already too late. But now, my listeners can get a trial month of everything you need to keep your hair for just $5 today, right now while supplies last. See the website for full details. Just go to forhims.com/undisclosed. That's forhims.com/undisclosed. forhims.com/undisclosed.
I just had some sort of housekeeping questions in terms of, because we got a lot of different witness statements and they all varied somewhat, you know, in the number of people in the car, in the way the events transpired exactly. Did Tae Jong Ho's girlfriend, Junko Nihai, was she able to speak English fluently? Could that have affected her witness statement?
Yeah, she was not able to speak English fluently. She was actually given a translator before she gave her statement. She understood a few things, but she was not fluent in English. And so, yeah, it definitely could have influenced her statement, what she said or what was actually transcribed onto the statement.
Whenever we've talked about these things, when these crimes have happened, I try to put myself sort of at the scene on that night. This was in late August in 1991 at 1 a.m. So this was probably a very hot summer night. I imagine if Philadelphia is anything like New York, a lot of people are still on the street at night because a lot of people's homes aren't air conditioned and you can't sleep a lot of the time. But it does sound like there was an awful lot of people on the street at 1 a.m. When this actually occurred. You know, at first it seemed like suspicious that there were so many witnesses, but it's not suspicious to me as a New Yorker.
No, not really as a Philadelphian either. It's a pretty highly trafficked area, no matter what time of day. And so that's not really that shocking to me that there were that many people. I was actually surprised there weren't even more people out because it is near a pretty main street. But it's not that shocking that there were that many people around.
Can you describe what it was like in the 90s? Because they mentioned that there had been a crime wave, that there had been several students at the university who had been victims of violent crime at that time. First of all, you know, what was it like then, and has it gotten any better since?
Well, back then it was bad. It was very, very violent. And there were a lot of students being killed, high school students, college students, just young people being killed. A lot of them were just random stick-ups for jewelry. And so there were a lot of wrongful convictions at the time, but there were also a lot of people who were arrested from the projects, who were kind of just rounded up and, you know, accused of doing certain things. There were, you know, a lot of people who were, when they were arrested, they were accused of being members of the junior black mafia, because police just assumed that if you were a young black man in the projects, you were up to no good back in the time. The homicide rate definitely has dropped in Philadelphia, but we still have a big problem with homicide in Philadelphia. The University of Pennsylvania itself definitely has gone through a lot of different changes over the time. I actually did graduate from there recently, and I never really felt unsafe walking around the campus. But this was off campus. And so, you know, it definitely has changed a little bit, but back in the 90s, it was, you know, when you walked in Philadelphia, you felt nervous. You didn't go in certain areas of the city. You always had to watch your back, and it was high crime, high drug violence. And so it was on the police to really try to make the public feel safe. And so there was a rush to judgment for a lot of these cases. And unfortunately, they ended in a lot of wrongful convictions. And a lot of people sent to jail just unnecessarily or for things that they didn't do.
Which makes me think that there's a lot of, well, I don't know a lot, but there must be people out there who have not served any jail time for, you know, the crimes they committed, right? If they're getting the wrong people, then there's got to be people out there who belong behind bars.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially for something like this, for murders. You know, we know that there are a lot of wrongful convictions in Philadelphia for murders. You've covered quite a few. I know of quite a few. And so you wonder how many other murders and other violent crimes were committed because of this rush to judgment back in the 80s and 90s.
Well, you mentioned that there were some red flags about the prosecutor on this case. Did you notice any patterns about his particular prosecutions that made you suspicious?
Yeah, Roger King. The first case that I really, really got into was that of Jimmy Dennis, who was also arrested in 1991 and wrongfully convicted of murder, and he was actually sent to death row. And Roger King, he tended to have kind of an aura of this imposing figure that he was terrifying. He was terrifying. If you see pictures of him, he walked around with bodyguards, and it doesn't seem the same as a lot of other types of DAs. And in all these cases, a lot of times he's accused of hiding information. He's accused of hiding homicide files. He's accused of, a case that I'm very familiar with of Terrence Williams. He was on death row for 32 years for a murder. He hid a lot of information about Terrence Williams' background that was never allowed to go in front of the jury. And they pulled the jury later, and a lot of the jurors said that they would have changed their sentence. They would have changed their decision if they knew this information. And so Roger King really had a pattern of hiding information from the jurors and from the defense in order to get convictions. He also used to really go for the death penalty in a lot of these cases when it was highly unnecessary. And unfortunately, a lot of people lost their lives because they have been incarcerated for decades because of Roger King's misconduct. And a lot of families lost their sons due to Roger King's misconduct.
You mentioned the case of Jimmy Dennis. Could you tell me a little bit about him and what's his current status?
Yeah. Jimmy is actually, he's fantastic. Jimmy spent 25 and a half years on death row. Out of SCI Green, outside of Pittsburgh, and they're in solitary confinement. I believe it's 23 hours out of the day. They're allowed out, I believe, 1 hour a day for exercise, and they're also allowed to, you know, go out for their jobs. I believe he worked in the law library. He was there, but he was recently released in May of last year. He is innocent, but unfortunately, he was forced to take a no contest plea, So he still has a murder conviction on his record because the city of Philadelphia refused to drop the charges. And this was under Seth Williams, who is now in federal prison. He was the former DA before Larry Krasner. And so Jimmy is home and he's doing wonderfully. He has a beautiful wife and he's been reunited with his daughters and his granddaughter. And it's amazing. I get to see him, here and there. And so it's really, really good to see him out and about and free. But it's unfortunate because he is not on the exoneration list because of the plea deal that he was forced to take. He has a murder conviction on his record. And so he's going to face problems that he should not have to face after the victimization that he was forced on to undergo for 25 and a half years.
Was he exonerated? What brought the plea deal to the fore?
Well, he was not exonerated, unfortunately, because you have to actually have your conviction overturned for the exoneration, which did not happen for him. But he had amazing representation out of D.C., and his conviction was overturned in the state Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. However, the option was either the state would either retry him, so basically he was facing either a retrial or hoping that they would let go of the charges. And unfortunately, they did not withdraw the charges. Seth Williams was refusing to withdraw the charges, and they said that they would probably end up retrying him. And so he was facing a number of years waiting for retrial and a number of years possibly awaiting for retrial. And then who knows what would have happened after that. And after 25 and a half years on death row, who could blame him for wanting to just come home when he had the opportunity? And so so he took that plea. And that happens a lot, unfortunately. It happens in a lot of cases.
Celeste, was it an Alford plea?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and that the Dennis case is a pretty important one in terms of Brady violations. It's something we're relying upon in the Willie Vesey case and the Terrence Lewis case. So that was an important ruling. Obviously, he didn't get his conviction completely erased. He had to plead guilty or enter this Alford plea. But yeah, the court's ruling finding there was a Brady violation here, I think, is important and something that we're definitely citing in some of our ongoing cases.
You mentioned a couple episodes that you mentioned the Anthony Wright case, which I don't actually know anything about. But he was in the news again recently because Malcolm Jenkins brought him to the Super Bowl. But and we know Anthony Wright's lawsuit was what brought out many of the files that were useful in the Willie Vesey case. But what is his background? What happened in that case and how did that end up affecting so many other cases?
So Malcolm Jenkins took Kempis Songster to the Super Bowl. He was a juvenile lifer who actually just got out very, very recently. And so he was the one who actually got to go to the Super Bowl with Malcolm Jenkins. But Anthony Wright is a fantastic human being. He actually served 25 years also in Philadelphia, not on death row. He spent most of his time up at Graterford. But he was also wrongfully convicted of a 1991 murder right around the same time. And he was actually exonerated by DNA. I believe in 2016, he was fully exonerated.
Yeah, he gave this confession to Martin Devlin, one of the members of the Wacker Squad involved in the interrogation of Willie Vesey. And the allegation was basically he was physically tortured or coerced into this confession. And so then basically after this DNA evidence exonerates Anthony Wright, he brings the lawsuit against the city, the state, this detective. And that's what led to the discovery documents in the Willie Vesey case that has now led to this new appeal in the case because it was the same detective. And so he got discovery and it was these files that were never turned over to the Willie Vesey defense team.
So he sued the detective individually?
Right. So he is bringing a Section 1983 action, which is claim of a violation of constitutional civil rights. And yeah, so his claim is my rights were violated by the city, by the individual detective. Now, there's a question of it's known as qualified immunity, which usually if the officer is acting within his function as a law enforcement officer, he is immune from prosecution. But there's a good argument here that, in fact, this was torture, which goes beyond what you would expect, of course, from a law enforcement officer, and that would therefore pierce this immunity and allow for the lawsuit to proceed.
And the judge ruled in favor of that, obviously.
That lawsuit's ongoing.
Oh, it is?
That has not been resolved, right? So that's the discovery files in that case we're using in the Willie Vesey case, but I don't think that case has gone to trial yet. Celeste, maybe you know more about the status of that current lawsuit.
I believe it's ongoing, yes.
But they turned over the documents at the beginning of it, I guess.
Right, during discovery, pre-trial, mm-hmm. right, he was asking for the homicide files and other cases where Martin Devlin, this member of the Wacker Squad, the detective, was the officer. And right, so one of those cases was Willie Vesey, and that then led to, oh, wait a second, these files show this Brady evidence that was never turned over to Vesey and his team.
Celeste, you're in contact with a lot of these men who have now been let out of prison. Obviously, it sounds like in some cases they, you know, they have wives, they have some sort of life to go out to. You know, I imagine they must be facing incredible difficulties trying to reintegrate with a life of freedom. I mean, what have you experienced them going through?
Well, I mean, it kind of ranges depending on how long they've been in prison and what type of prison they were in and what their conditions were. I mean, obviously, anybody who's been on death row and in solitary confinement for a number of decades is going to have mental health concerns going forward. Anybody who has been in prison at all is going to have mental health concerns going forward, you know, issues with interpersonal relationships, jobs, budgeting, things like that. But one of the main concerns with people who are reintegrating in Pennsylvania is that Pennsylvania doesn't compensate if you are wrongfully convicted. And so if you are innocent and your conviction is overturned, you're exonerated in Pennsylvania, you go home with absolutely nothing. You have to sue, just like Anthony Wright did, you have to sue the city or something like that, which sometimes takes years and sometimes can be expensive to do or isn't successful. And so the state has already stolen so many decades of their lives and everything that goes with that. There's no, you know, not many skill trainings in prisons, and then they're set free and expected to reintegrate flawlessly without any sort of help or apology. And so it's really unfortunate in states like Pennsylvania for these men who are going home, who have been largely unprepared for adulthood and then have had a lot of their lives stolen and are not given anything to help them have a leg up. Now, in Philadelphia, there are amazing reentry resources, a reentry coalition. So there are really great resources for these men and women who are reentering in Philadelphia. But still, there are issues with holding down employment, finding housing, you know, just all of those things that normal adults might even struggle navigating. It's much more difficult when you've spent however many years in prison without you know, experiencing the technology and things like that that you kind of have to know how to use whenever you're in the world.
Well, and you mentioned an apology. I would imagine that would be incredibly valuable to the mental health of people. Now, those reentry services you mentioned, are those state reentry services or are those private organizations?
A lot of them are more private organizations. Some are city, some are state, but a lot of them are private, nonprofit type things. But yeah, as you said, I mean, an apology would go a very long way for these people who have had their lives stolen by the system and are given absolutely nothing. You're right. An apology would definitely go a very long way, I feel.
You mentioned Larry Krasner earlier, the new DA in Philadelphia. And there was an article recently where he mentioned that he wanted to address the cycle of trauma in the justice system. That's kind of a new approach, actually. I don't recall DAs ever talking about that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very progressive approach. And it's wonderful to hear as somebody who's an advocate for the actual individuals who are being put through this. You do become a victim when you're within the criminal justice system. And, you know, our society is very individualistic and they think, oh, well, hey, you must have done something. Or even if you did do something, you deserve the type of treatment that you get while you're in prison. But, you know, prisoners do have rights. They are humans. And unfortunately, a lot of times those rights are not exercised in a fair manner if you are incarcerated. And so, you know, the cycle of trauma, it affects not just the people who are incarcerated or who have contact with the justice system, but this affects families. There are children whose parents are, you know, incarcerated and they're lost. They're left, you know, just to fend for themselves or, you know, and their rates of incarceration then go up. And so I think it's a really progressive and refreshing approach that Larry Krasner is taking to be able to actually look at, the cycle of trauma within the criminal justice system, because it's not something that's easy to deal with for those who have actually been involved.
And he also actually mentioned in the context of the article the trauma that happens to police officers and to prosecutors. I actually had a friend who was functioned as a prosecutor in the children's court system. And I have to say he experienced the trauma as well, you know, with just being around the constant violence. But I thought it was I wouldn't know where a DA could start to address that cycle of trauma. But I thought it was really interesting that he wanted to try.
Yeah, I mean, I know he has, I believe, an Office of Victims' Rights now, which is great. He, I believe, integrated some sort of immigration rights office within his office. And so I think he's really looking at expanding kind of the scope of what the DA's office does, and not just looking at it as a prosecutor's office, but kind of a holistic approach to how to address justice in Philadelphia. And that would also include prosecutors and police officers, too. I mean, as much as we talk about wrongful convictions and misconduct on the part of people who are involved, it's true. They do experience and internalize a lot of the grief and a lot of the violence that they have to experience and the stress that goes along with that type of occupation. That also can't be understated, and it definitely needs to be addressed.
From the creators of Missing Maura Murray and Crawl Space comes Empty Frames, a new investigative podcast aiming to find answers to one of the biggest mysteries the world has ever seen. In the early morning hours of March 18th, 1990, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, Massachusetts, fell victim to the most audacious art heist in modern history. In 81 minutes, two thieves dressed as policemen made off with 13 pieces of artwork, with an estimated value of $500 million. Works by Vermeer, Degas, and Rembrandt were stripped from their frames, never to be seen by the public again. Vermeer's The Consort was among the stolen pieces and is considered to be the most valuable stolen property in the whole world. And deep within the criminal underground, theories of their whereabouts and those who perpetrated the heist are abundant. Are they being kept together in conditions conducive to such fragile works? Have they been determined to be too hot to handle? And were they destroyed? In Empty Frames, Tim and Lance from the popular true crime podcast Missing Maura Murray and Crawl Space will dive into the case, exploring all angles. Along with investigators, reporters, art theft experts, and citizens, they will paint their own portrait comprised of the theories and the social and economic impact the greatest unsolved art heist of all time had on a community. So search and subscribe to Empty Frames today on Apple Podcasts or your favorite listening destination. Empty Frames, the biggest mystery the world has ever seen.
Now, getting back to Chester, in the Terrence Lewis case, we were talking about the possibility of him being resentenced because he was a juvenile lifer. But Chester was a little bit older. Is that a possibility for people older than 18, you know, maybe to 21?
It'd be lovely. Unfortunately, I don't believe so as far as right now. I studied a lot of neuroscience and neurocriminology, and it shows that you're definitely incapable of making fully rational decisions until you're about 25. And so it seems as though 18 is a pretty trivial and arbitrary cutoff to apply this type of retroactive sentencing. I believe that people who would commit crimes at 21 should also be considered for this type of resentencing. This also is kind of the age crime curve. People usually will age out of a criminal lifestyle, as they get a little bit older. And so I think 18 is definitely, I understand there has to be a cutoff, but I think 18 is a bit of a trivial cutoff. I remember being 19, I remember being 20, and I definitely wouldn't do a lot of the things that I did at that age now, being 36. And so I think that if the justice system really looked at science and kind of used that to look at sentencing structures, I think that we might be able to kind of convince them to look at this. And I know they're not juveniles, but maybe look at people who were sentenced in their early 20s and try to figure out a way that we could resentence them to a lesser time.
Yeah, there's been some litigation on this, including a case out of Pennsylvania, and Celeste is exactly right. The same brain science that was used in cases like Miller versus Alabama on juvenile sentencing shows that the frontal lobe and the connections in the brain, they're not fully developed until sort of the mid-20s. And so some litigants have said, well, you're having resentencing for juveniles. Well, I committed my crime, 18, 19, 20, 21, et cetera. Shouldn't those same resentencing laws apply to me? And so far, those lawsuits have not been successful. But as we've noted on the podcast, there have been some positive developments on juvenile sentencing and juvenile resentencing. So it's certainly possible in a few years we might see some courts moving on this and saying we recognize the brain science indicates that people before the mid-20s don't have the fully developed brain and therefore they're entitled to new sentences. But at least at this point, someone like Chester Holman can't get the same type of relief as someone like Terrence Lewis.
But I understand that the state going for clarity here, you know, when they say, look, it's 18. Okay, that's it. You know, because they have to create a boundary somewhere. While, of course, reality is it's a spectrum. You know, there's 18-year-olds I've met who were not mature, you know, and then there's 18-year-olds I met who I would love to have as an attorney representing me. You know, it varies from person to person, but I understand the state's impulse to create a boundary.
But I also think we have to look at this even in a more broader sense of, like, why do we impose life sentences that actually mean the natural life of that person, right? I mean, so there are people who right now are so elderly in prison, right? Maybe they were 30, 40 years old when they committed a crime, but they're like in their 70s and 80s. There are many other countries we can look at to take as models. They don't impose the kinds of sentences we impose, right? Like, I just think sentencing overall needs some reformation. I think our sentences are egregious, especially for nonviolent crimes, but even for violent crimes. I mean, of course, there's always depending on the nature of the crime, but I'm pretty sure the United States has some of the, maybe the longest sentences for crimes as compared to many other countries, especially in the Western context.
Yeah, and that ties back into the discussion of trauma before. In Miller versus Alabama, that case where they said we can't have mandatory life without parole for juveniles, we need to have an individualized sentencing hearing. Part of what they focused on was to say when the prison system knows a juvenile is not going to get paroled, they get lesser education, they are not being prepared to reintegrate in society, they're treated fundamentally differently. And it's just that hope, that possibility of release that often results in that inmate feeling they can change and they can become a different person. And so, yeah, John, I understand certainly courts to this point have said it's a hard line. Below a certain age, you're a juvenile and these laws apply. And above that, you're not. But yeah, what message are we sending to that 19 or 20-year-old who is absolutely committed a heinous crime, but you know, they're being told, look, you're going to be in prison the rest of your life. You have no chance of getting out. You know, what effort are they going to put in to become a better person? And on the prison side, what effort are they going to put in to try to make sure this person is rehabilitated?
Yeah, I think that actually is a really good point to kind of go back to talk about Terrence Williams' case. He committed two murders. He had a long history of violent trauma in his life, which was covered up by Roger King during his trial. And he was sent to death row at age 18. So, you know, he had just crossed that line of being able to possibly get any sort of relief under this new law, this new ruling. And, you know, his personal trauma background was not considered in sentencing, and he was sent to death row. Luckily, he was just resentenced to life without parole. But still, what kind of message does that send to a person when we send them to jail for the rest of their natural lives, whether it's on death row or not, you know, at age 18. And you know, there's no sort of treatment or therapy to kind of help rectify the trauma that he was put under. And now that he's, you know, on in general population, I'm sure, I mean, I know for a fact he's not getting the mental health treatment that he deserves and should be getting after spending 32 years in isolation. And so, you know, what kind of message did that send to him as a person? What kind of hope are we giving him as a person or to try to, you know, overcome his obstacles, sending him to death row at 18 for something that he did when he was a teenager?
Speaking of juvenile life without parole, there was recently an article in the Washington Post about a lawsuit in Maryland that could possibly affect the Adnan Syed case. Colin, what's your take on that?
Yeah, and so as we've said, there was this key Supreme Court case, Miller versus Alabama, which has led to all these juvenile resentencing hearings, including the one that's upcoming for Terrence Lewis. Adnan Syed, of course, was not given a life without parole sentence. He was given a sentence of life with the possibility of parole. But it turns out that Maryland is one of three states, the other two are California and Oklahoma, that say even with a sentence of life without parole, to get parole, there has to be the signature of the governor. And in Maryland, since the mid-90s, the governor has not signed off on parole in a single murder case in Maryland. And so this lawsuit in Maryland is saying that functionally, a life sentence for a juvenile in Maryland is life without parole, even if it's not technically a life without parole sentence. And so this was an article in the Washington Post. It was talking about one of these cases in Maryland, a man named James Bowie. And yeah, I mean, the lawsuit, I think, certainly has some merit. And if the court there in Maryland decides it's meritorious, then that means that someone like Adnan Syed would be entitled to some type of relief.
But that would be a parole hearing. And as we understand, often parole hearings are subjected to the convicted person's admitting the crime. And it seems like it's very rare that people who still claim innocence are given parole. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. It's still a case where, based upon his claim of innocence over the years, exceedingly unlikely he would make parole. And of course, he's been given a new trial. And assuming that's upheld, he won't have to have resentencing. But at least some hope in the case in the event that, for whatever reason, his new trial is overturned on appeal.
And Rabia, I recall, recently, well, actually, it was probably about a year ago, that Adnan had been experiencing some illnesses in prison. How is he doing now?
He seems better. I saw him it's been about 2 months, I think, since I saw him. And he certainly is in better physical shape it was a while ago when he was, I don't know, he had some major issues with his neck and shoulders and head, and he couldn't turn. So he seems better. But the other thing is, what happened when that was reported publicly, there was it became a Baltimore Sun article and all this. It kind of made life a little harder for him. And I think even if he's not doing so well, he's going to be much more careful telling his family and friends, because then we get concerned and sometimes we make the call that maybe being public about it is the way to fix it, when it actually can have a detrimental impact on his relationships inside the prison. So at this point, I can just assess, him just by looking at him. But if I ever ask him again, I think he'll be like, I'm fine, thank you. So that's unfortunate.
It is really unfortunate because it just adds to the isolation. You know, when he has to make a judgment call about what he can tell people, because it might end up on the cover of the Baltimore Sun. I can't imagine that facilitates good conversations.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've got some social media questions. We've got one from Green the Marine, who says, how is the situation in Pennsylvania with discovery not a massive civil/constitutional rights lawsuit?
It is, and that's...
it is. That's the answer.
Sort of as I mentioned before, that James Dennis case that we were discussing before, I think, is a key ruling saying that this was a Brady violation. And as we can see just from that case, we've gotten files in the Willie Vesey case. There might be other files that are out there in other cases that are leading to similar lawsuits. So, yeah, I think this practice in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania of not turning over homicide files, key evidence, other people confessing, other statements that contradict witness statements, it's been going on for years. And you hope with the new Krasner administration and some of this new case law, we're going to start to see some of these wrongs finally being remedied.
We've got another question from AE Sports Star, who says, I started listening to the new case, and I don't know. At this point in time, I would have to say maybe this guy is guilty, hoping that you can change my mind.
And I felt the same way when I first kind of looked at the facts on the face of them. It's like, I mean, it's just such a coincidence. But then if you really think about it, a lot of wrongful convictions kind of end up looking like that. You end up thinking, just wait. It would take too many coincidences for this person to have been arrested for this crime. And you know, it turns out that it's not just coincidences. It's people making things happen to get a certain outcome. And so I urge our listeners to keep listening, and we'll show how, I mean, basically we wouldn't be doing this case if we didn't believe he was innocent.
We've also got a question from Evan M. Fitzgerald. He said, just listen to most of the first episode. Just stick it out, dude. You can finish it. And I thought Google might help find the missing playground. Seems the most likely case is that elementary school right there. Were you guys discounting the elementary school that was right there?
I don't know which elementary school it is. I didn't see one.
I don't know what he's referring to.
In the vicinity. I mean, I don't know, Celeste, unless you can recall. I actually did not do a drive-by of the area. I had to use, whatever tools I had online to look for the playground that one of the witnesses said that he was at, Coleman was at. And I didn't find anything that looked like it could be situated in a way that everything else that he said about, you know, witnessing these guys, which way they were taking off and where the car, where this Blazer was parked. I mean, frankly, a lot of what he said, none of it made sense. I mean, he thought these guys were like between 14 and 16. He saw the white Blazer, not at a gas station like the other witnesses, but at a bus stop. So I'm not quite sure what's going on with him.
Yeah, I agree. I think just based on where he was located, just the mention of a playground was a little odd. I believe there is a school close to there, but just from where he said he was positioned, it seemed a little strange.
Okay, we've got another question from Jen LBMB, who says, I just finished listening to Prison for Children. What are your thoughts on the sentences for the Slender Man attackers? I'm not familiar with what they actually were sentenced to.
I believe one of the young women was sentenced to 40 years at a psychiatric institution. Another one was sentenced, I think, to 25 years in prison. I'm not sure about that, but I'm assuming the listener is asking about this sentence of 40 years, a maximum of 40 years in psychiatric institution. I don't really know what to think about this. I mean, it is a maximum sentence. It's not a hard and fast sentence. It maybe is a good thing that she's being sentenced to a psychiatric institution and not prison, because that's probably where she likely belongs. I just don't know. I don't know enough actually about, you know, cases like this in which, and it'd be interesting, maybe Colin knows more about this, in which sentences are, I mean, like in a case like this, for example, would she serve some time here and then maybe be moved to a prison if they felt like she was doing better? Or if she got healthier mentally, would they release her? How does this work, Colin? Do you know?
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with this. The Slender Man, my understanding is these two 12-year-old girls, and there was this sort of internet meme, Slender Man, and it was this fictional supernatural guy, and these two 12-year-olds used him as inspiration and stabbed their other 12-year-old friend, and they had a variety of mental health issues. And I mean, typically the way it would work is if they're found not guilty by reason of insanity, they're sent to a mental institution, they're treated, and they're treated until they're no longer a threat to themselves or others. And at that point, the person can be released. I just did like a quick search to see that the one just got the 40 years in a mental institution. I'm not sure in Wisconsin, where this case took place, exactly how that works, but it certainly sounds, and I didn't watch the documentary on this or know all the details, so it's tough for me to assess it, but it seems right that the one at least is going to a mental health facility as opposed to a prison, because notoriously prisons are bad at treating mental illness, and so it's good she's being sent there as opposed to a prison. Beyond that, it's a little tough for me to say too much about the case.
And the other young lady was sentenced to 25 years early in December to a psychiatric institution.
One thing I think people have to be careful about is any wildly famous case that invokes something about pop culture that's really scaring people at the time. I think the Slender Man thing touches on, video game addiction. I think it touches on, you know, what a lot of people are uncomfortable with in just floating in the zeitgeist in terms of computer gaming. And that, you know, what type of society is evolving from that. So it sounds to me like a fairly considered sentence, because in cases usually where, you know, everybody's really you know, where the media is involved, very often the prosecution or judges come down very, very hard on those people. And while 40 years sounds like a long time in that kind of situation, my understanding is in psychiatric facilities, it's a lot more dependent on the state of their mental health than anything else.
Right. It sounds right to me.
Yeah. So we've got another question from MCA CED, who says, I'm looking forward to hearing the new series arc. Was wondering if you heard any updates on the Walter Ograd case out of Philadelphia. That'd be a no, then, I guess. Radio silence on Walter Ograd. Okay, well, you know, we don't have any updates.
Yeah, that's the case where he is another client of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. We actually talked with him about possibly presenting on the podcast, but he's on death row. There was a book that came out, I think, last year, the year before, making a claim for his innocence. And we had talked with them, but for a variety of reasons, decided not to take the case. And I'm not sure if there's been any update in his legal status.
I actually had a question. Okay, Sean Thomas and Willie Vesey were represented by the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, but Terrence Lewis and Chester Holman weren't. Why was Chester Holman able to find a lawyer to work pro bono? Was that how that worked?
Chester Holman's actually always had amazing representation paid for by his family. Chester's case is slightly different from a lot of the wrongful conviction cases that I come across in Philadelphia, because he wasn't from the inner city. He wasn't from the projects. He wasn't raised in poverty. He was raised in the suburbs with a very, very hardworking family with both, parents. His dad worked, two and three jobs and financed Chester's defense this entire time. So Chester always did have, paid legal representation throughout his case. It was just, a little bit iffy in the earlier years.
And is his current representation paid or is it pro bono?
I believe he started paid, but I think at this point he's working on the case pretty much pro bono because he believes so much in Chester's innocence. And at this point, Chester's father is in his 70s and retired, and you have to feel some sort of great sense of empathy for that family who's pretty much been bankrupted by the system.
Yeah, I would have to figure legal representation for this length of time would just be a crushing financial blow.
Yeah, Alan Tauber is his attorney. I think he's been representing him for about 12 or 13 years now. It's a very long time. But also, he is working with the Pennsylvania. The Innocence Project had this case before, right? Before Alan got it.
I believe how it happened, the timeline, and we'll have to double check this, but I believe what happened is that actually Alan Tauber had it, but then I believe he reached out to the Innocence Project when the Innocence Project started up. And so the Innocence Project, I believe, has kind of had something to do with his case, but is not necessarily the representation of his case that would be Alan Tauber.
They've been assisting, yeah.
Yeah, and this all ties back to the New York Times article we mentioned on the podcast, the study about the 1.5 million missing Black men. That's a study that's about the impact on their families, whether it be spouses, children, or parents. And yeah, I mean, it's just incredible that over all these years, as you say, as parents have been paying for legal representation, that just has to be emotionally, financially, just so taxing on them to have been supporting his case all these years and still meeting so much resistance.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, they were naive to the legal system when this whole thing began because they had never had contact with the legal system. And so there have been times where they've kind of been bamboozled by different investigators or lawyers who have gone through and charged them for things and never actually followed through. So it's really a shame, and it adds another layer of horror to the story of Chester Holman.
We've got another question from The Boy Chunder, who says, do you have any plans to cover a case fully like you did with Adnan and Joey's case? These past few cases have been great, but they have been very short. They are so short, in my mind, they're blending into one.
You know, one reason they're probably blending into one is we're seeing the same cops over and over again.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah, and, brace yourself. You're going to see some of the same ones again. And also because it's the same kind of techniques. It's the same era. There was a gang of law enforcement folks who were just kind of using the same techniques to get their guy. But we are. We have a long series in the works for, I think, June or the summer at some point, I think, that's going to be one of those, you know, a non-Joey type, really long ones, in-depth ones. Those just take a lot longer to prepare. And I'm sure folks can appreciate that. So, but we certainly don't want to give people any dead air. We don't want to, you know, give you months and months of silence as we are preparing a more in-depth series. So we'd like to keep covering cases, even if they're shorter series. And also we want to be helping folks to the extent that we can by raising awareness about their cases.
Yeah, and part of the reason that some of these series have been short is there's just so little evidence against the defendant. That's part of why we want to present them. Is you look at a case like Terrence Lewis, where it's literally one witness against him and has all sorts of issues. Or we will look at the Willie Vesey case where, yeah, he gave a confession. It doesn't match with the evidence that's surrounding. And again, we have sort of this one witness. So, yeah, unlike Adnan Syed or Joey Watkins, where there are so many different issues and evidence you have to discuss, a lot of these cases we've been covering recently, it's just sort of a one witness, one piece of evidence case, and it lends itself toward the shorter series. But as Rabia noted, this summer we'll have a full-blown longer series to cover again.
And we've got one last question from Ali Mattson, who says, I was trying to find out what the latest status on Adnan's case was. I started Googling it and kept seeing a lot from June of last year. I figured you all would know best where everyone stands. Thanks in advance.
Yeah, June of last year, June of 2016, actually, is when his conviction was overturned. The state appealed it. Since then, the case has been with COSA, which is the Court of Special Appeals in Maryland. We had oral arguments this past May. We are hoping and expecting a decision on this, on the appeal and the cross appeal that we filed in the next month or so. So fingers crossed. Basically, we are just stuck in appeals, and that's all it is. But the decision that's coming up would hopefully affirm his right to a new trial.
Yeah, and Steve Klepper, who's an expert in Maryland law, has crunched the numbers and looked at when these decisions typically come. His prediction is that last week of February or the very beginning of March. That's my prediction, too. We never know. It could be longer than that. But my expectation, my hope is end of February, that last Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we're going to get an opinion.
That's all the questions I've got. Colin, Rabia, do you have any questions for Celeste?
Celeste, because you mentioned it before, you've mentioned you are in contact with some other inmates in Pennsylvania or Philadelphia who you strongly believe in their innocence. Is there anyone you sort of want to throw out there as someone you know?
Who
you
think there are a couple. I mean, right now, Ralph Trent Stokes, he's been on Pennsylvania's death row out at SCI Green for 36 years. His birthday is actually tomorrow. So happy 55th birthday to Ralph. He got arrested when he was 19 for a triple homicide. It was a very high profile case in a restaurant that Joe Frazier owned. And they needed, again, to try to convict somebody quickly. And they went for him. And unfortunately, he has been in solitary confinement for 36 years. He was also a Roger King case and very, very similar tactics. And Isaiah Givens, who was also, he was convicted right after Ralph Stokes of a shooting in the projects, and he's also innocent, and he has really been suffering a lot of medical issues in prison. He has been untreated for something that he was diagnosed with about 20 years ago called Berger's disease, and they never told him they had it, and they never gave him any sort of treatment for it. And unfortunately, he is now having to have toes amputated and going through some really awful medical treatment for that. And he's innocent. And so it's really, really hard for a lot of these guys, you know, and so it's nice for people to reach out. So if you do get a chance, I can always post addresses for people, these guys that, you know, I'm in contact with, to try to send them cards or just messages of hope or support to let them know that you are thinking about them, because it means the world to them.
Yeah. Celeste, where can people find you on social media?
Okay, well, basically my Twitter handle is @thejuryroomblog. And you mentioned my blog before, but it is thejuryroom.org. And I also have a Facebook page, The Jury Room. So any of those places, and anybody can feel free to reach out. A lot of times I do post a lot on Twitter about wrongful convictions and the guys that I'm supporting and ways that you can reach out and support them. I just did a drive to try to get people to send Ralph Stokes birthday cards on death row. So I know his birthday is tomorrow, but if you find it in your heart, you can send him a birthday card. It's okay if it goes late.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Celeste.
Of course. Thank you guys so much for having me. And thank you again for doing Chester's case. He appreciates it so much.
Yes. Thank you, Rabia. Thank you, Colin. And that's another addendum on the books. If you feel like checking out our website, undisclosed-podcast.com, please do. There's a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to there. I am donating all of my fees for this series to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and you can help them as well at their website, innocenceprojectpa.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle, @UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I'm going to thank my assistant, Andrew Cogden, once again for his help. I also want to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and Methil Telhan, our project manager. Looking forward to next week's episode. See you then.